Coming up on today's show.
I started taking Adderall, and it just went from taking it when I was riding to then I would take it if I had chores to do or make a long drive or anything like that. And then it went from that to every single day when I wake up, I'd have to take Adderall just to feel normal.
A Tennessee tornado wrecking off the rails.
Welcome to another new episode of Now Hear This Entertainment, featuring interviews with guests who are having success in entertainment, primarily music. I am Bruce Wozniak, proud member of the Recording Academy, talking to guests who are singers, songwriters, musicians, recording artists, and more from the worldwide music community. Get in touch with me by writing to podcast@nhte.net, or instead of email, you can DM me through the @NowHearThisEntertainment Instagram account. Joining me today on the Now Hear This Entertainment guest line from Nashville, my guest is a chart-topping songwriter, solo artist, multi-platinum award winner, and soul singer. Last October, he released a 5-song EP that got approximately 3 million streams across all platforms. He is renowned for crafting number one country radio hits such as Gary Allen's Every Storm, Runs Out of Rain, and earning prestigious ASCAP awards and an ACM Song of the Year nomination. He is signed with The Table Entertainment Company and has a publishing deal with Lady Luck Songs. He has had cuts with the likes of Darius Rucker, Bucky Covington, The Voice Season 17 winner Jake Hoot, and many more. He is also one of the founders of the Las Vegas Songwriters Festival, which comes up this August at Mandalay Bay Resort and Casino on the Strip. You have been hearing a song of his called Long Story. Welcome to Now Hear This Entertainment, Matt Warren.
Thanks for having me, Bruce. It's an honor to be on.
Thank you. I appreciate you making time to talk with me today. Let's get started by having you share first all about the song of yours that was just playing during the intro called Long Story.
Yeah, Long Story is a song that, well, I guess I should backtrack a little bit. I had my whole writing career for many years. I signed my first publishing deal in 2002, and in 2019, I kind of crashed and burned, if you will, ended up in rehab and got sober in 2019. And up until that point on my publishing deals, I would just go in and write what I wanted to write, and I wasn't really concerned about, you know, pitch sheets or who was looking for a song. I was just trying to write the whatever, what I felt was the best thing in the room that day. And after I got out of rehab and got sober, I had an opportunity in 2022 to come back to a publishing company and write, basically what we call row writing, which is, you know, you're trying to get songs cut by other artists. And so I took a different approach back in 2022 and started, really listening to, you know, who was looking for songs, who was making records. And my co-writers for Long Story, who are Skip Black and Nicole Witt, Skip came in and said, you know, what should we write about today? And I said, I'm game for whatever. And he said, well, I've got a connection, an end to Jelly Roll. And he was talking to me and he said, you know, you're a Nashville native. We're going to need some of that, you know, some Nashville imagery and stuff to paint this song, you know, because Jelly Roll is also a Nashville native. And so we started out writing that song as to try to get something to Jelly Roll. So Skip made the demo for the song and kind of put like a beat on it and a track. And it wasn't really necessarily my thing per se, but I did enjoy listening to it, and everybody around me in my camp, they really loved the song. And and so when I went to make my new EP, my producers, we were looking at the songs that that we could potentially cut, and everybody agreed. They said, man, this Long Story is really cool. And I said, well, not every lyric in there is, you know, really not about me, because we were trying to write it for Jelly Roll. Mm. And they all brought it up to me. They said, well, you know, not every song you've ever written is about you. And, you know, you've sang, you know, songs that you've written that weren't necessarily about you. You know, why don't we just go that route with this? And so as we were cutting the song, it really dawned on me that my brother also had struggled with drug addiction and alcoholism for many, many years. And as we were cutting the song, it really dawned on me that that song is really more about my brother than it is about me or Jelly Roll. Mm. And my brother's doing fantastic now. And so I thought, man, what a great way to kind of tribute my brother, who's also turned the corner. And so it worked out that that life was imitating art on this song. And so we're excited about it. And it's done pretty well in Texas. And that's kind of the backstory behind Long Story. And of course we got my friend LB Shane, who's a country artist, is featured on there. He's singing with me, and we had a lot of fun writing that song and recording it.
What a great story. And you're humble to say that you know, that you've had some success with it. You know, the EP itself overall getting approximately 3 million streams across all platforms. Obviously it's done really well. And I love the way that worked out. You know, that it's kind of that thing of, you know, you think you're writing it for one thing or for one artist, and lo and behold, it's kind of like the guests that will come on the show and say, it was the song that I thought was going to be a hit that didn't really do much, and the song that I didn't really think was going to do much that ended up being really successful. So here's this route that you took of, we think we're writing for Jelly Roll. Gee, this song isn't really about me. Oh my gosh, this is actually about my brother. This is, in fact, perfect for me to record.
Yes. Yes, it was, you can call it a God thing, I guess. I mean, we were just so excited. Once I got my head around the fact that, like, okay, this is for my brother, then I could really put myself into it. And that's all I needed.
But just explain, Matt, to the casual listener, the difference between this song isn't necessarily about me versus a song that someone brings to you and you say, this isn't something that I would really sing.
Yeah, so I think more times than not, if someone were to, I guess I could look at it like, you know, I'm a huge Bob Dylan fan. You know, if somebody were to send me a Bob Dylan song that I really loved and loved to sing, but it wasn't about me at all, and I really couldn't identify with it, maybe I may be more apt to cut a song like that only because it was such an influence on me, mm-hmm. and maybe an influence on culture, on pop culture, as opposed to, I guess, if it's another songwriter that's in town currently doing the same thing, it would just really have to resonate with me, like someone wrote my life story or wrote something that I really, really loved, and it'd have to have the same kind of phrasing that I enjoyed to sing, the, you know, melodies that were fun for me to sing. All of those things have to line up if I am not the one writing the song. I noticed that with when I'm going to choose cover songs to sing with my band, at the end of the day, a song has to be fun for me, because if I'm enjoying the song, the crowd will pick up on that. If I'm just phoning something in because everyone around me says, this is a great song, we think you should do this, the people will be able to tell whether I like that or not. So
yeah.
I guess I probably still haven't answered your question.
No, you did. You did. I like the Bob Dylan example. And even that, what you just said is important, because you're right. The crowd is going to notice. And by the way, you know, hats off to your team for telling you, well, look, you've done other songs before that weren't about you. Because I think that's important, because you being on the front line as the artist, you are going to look at the song and you're going to say, I don't really know that I want to record this. It's not really about me. So I like that they came forward to you and said, it's not going to be the first time that you did that.
Well, and that's why it takes a village, you know, because, I mean, there are some artists who are just so dialed into, they want to make up their own record covers. They want to have their hands in, not just have their hands into every aspect of their artistry, but like really, really control it. You know, I've been in a band, I'll be 50 in May, and I've been in a band since I was 16 years old. Mm. And what I've noticed on this go around, I really wanted to, because it was the first time I really had a team around me. I had two producers. I've always kind of produced my own records, but I had two producers, two guys that I've been collaborating with for a long time. And I have a manager and my publisher, and I have a team that's my financial backing. And so what I did on this project was just kind of say, you know what, I'm going to send you guys about 20 songs and let's pick 10 of them. You'll already know that I like these songs because I'm going to send them to you. So tell me what you guys think. And you know what, man, there was I had a lot of peace and joy making this project because I didn't have to be so in it, if that makes any sense. Like I kind of relinquished all of the, hey, we should do this, we should do that, because I really trust my team. And I wanted to take just a snapshot of what was going on in my life at the time. Like, that's how we chose the songs for the record. I had just come off of listening to this Rick Rubin podcast, and he made some really incredible statements. And one that really resonated with me is he said, you know, if you're not making art for yourself, then what are you doing it for? You know, like, you can't make art for other people. Like, and I realized that in Nashville, there's so many great songwriters who love to make art for other people, and they want to write songs for other people. And I've never really been that guy. I got signed to my first publishing deal because Rick Hall out of Muscle Shoals in Alabama at Fame, they believed in me as an artist and sent my record to Clive Davis. And so I've always approached songwriting like from my perspective as an artist. But, you know, after listening to Rick Rubin, I just found that to be so true, that if I'm making music for someone else, then everybody in the room is going to know it. And so at the end of the day, I'm just trying to make records that I would listen to going down a back road, or if I was brokenhearted, or, you know, what would I want to listen to?
Wow. And let's face it, you know, there's strength in numbers. And later on during the conversation, we're going to be talking about the Las Vegas Songwriters Festival. So I'll make a gambling analogy. But I think what you just described is you doing everything yourself. And in other words, pushing all your chips into the table and going, I'm going to bet it all on black, as opposed to the strategy that my wife has for playing roulette, which is, well, no, we put some over here, we put some chips over here, we put some here, and then some here, which is all the members of your team around you saying, look, we're going to have success. It's just better if we all kind of look at it as a group and say, this is the roadmap to get there, instead of you with the weight of the world on your shoulders saying, all right, I've made all these decisions in a vacuum by myself. I sure think that they're good decisions. Like, do you really?
Yeah. I mean, dude, you nailed it. And there's not, I mean, I've been doing this for over almost 25 years, and it can be so stressful and take a lot of the joy and fun out of making art when you put all that pressure on yourself.
100%.
And I have been, you know, road riding in Nashville. I often say I really don't need anyone else to help me write a song. I've written many songs by myself, and I enjoy that process. But if I'm writing for money, and I'm writing for survival, and I'm writing for rent money, and, you know, just to, I want to have, you know, I like to have two or three heads on it, you know, so that translated over into my business plan, and, you know, and my plan is my artistry. It's like, you know, I've gotten so used to, you know, if three of us are writing a song, I may not be on that day, but one of my co-writers or both of my co-writers may be on. And at that point, I'm just the salt and the pepper for the dish. You know, sometimes as a writer, you come in and you I've got the idea. I'm like, man, this song is about, you know, it's about my mom and my dad when I was a kid, and how they, you know, they would always come to all of my baseball games. You know, at that point, my other two writers are going, okay, wow, he just painted the picture. We're there. We've got this. So all they're really doing is at that point is helping me to paint that picture.
Yeah.
And then some days I'm the one that's helping someone else.
Yep.
So I thought, you know what? I could sit here all day and listen to my own record and listen to these songs and go, oh, I love all 20 of these, but I wanted to have other heads on it going, yeah, well, we agree. We think these are great, but we really think there's something with this.
Yeah. Well said. Well said. And audience, you heard Matt mention Elvie Shane doing vocals on the song that he was talking about that was playing during the intro. Long story. Go back, 2 years ago already now? Go back to episode 528 of this show and my interview with Russell Sutton. We had a lot of fun. We recorded that there in Nashville. Russell Sutton's first number one single was with Elvie Shane. I will put a link to it on the show page for this episode on my podcast website, nhte.net. Matt, you said this very quickly when you were talking about writing for Jelly Roll, but you probably more than anyone can imagine how many guests I've had come on this show over the last 12 plus years and talk about when and why they moved to Nashville. Folks, I have to tell you, this is a rarity. Matt, you actually were born and raised in Nashville. Granted, someone can be born and raised there and do something having nothing to do with music. But Matt, what was your story there? When and how did you first start into music? But then also, when did you know that it was, in fact, what you wanted to do for a living?
I loved singing ever since I was a little kid. I used to lock myself in the bedroom, and I was really into my parents' music. My parents were into, you know, Steely Dan and Bob Dylan and the Stones and the Grateful Dead and the Allman Brothers. And from that spectrum to Neil Young and to Bruce Hornsby to the Gaithers, Joni Mitchell. I mean, the wow, spectrum of the music that my parents were into was so broad. And they also loved pop music. I mean, my first concert was, my mom took me to see Huey Lewis in the News.
Wow.
We were all, you know, we loved Huey Lewis in the News. But the first artist that I ever really fell in love with, like on my own, was Michael Jackson. You know, the Thriller record was so big. And then, and so once I got into Thriller, my parents encouraged me to go back and listen to the Jackson 5.
Wow.
And so I really got into the Jackson 5. But anyway, I'd be in my room, and I loved singing those songs. I felt like I could sing. I was a little nervous to do it in front of anyone. I remember trying out for the church choir, and I didn't make it. And I thought that was really odd, because at church, I guess everybody's supposed to make the choir, but I didn't. And so I had a little bit of a complex until high school. All of my friends were taking electives in the ninth grade, and they said, man, you should do chorus. You know, we're going to go in there, and it should be fun. And so I gathered up the courage. I tried out for chorus in my 10th grade year, and my teacher was like, wow, where have you been? And gave me a solo that Christmas. I sang Jingle Bell Rock. And I think it was then, because I had been a five-sport athlete pretty much my whole life. I've played tons of sports, and those are all team things. And all of a sudden, when I walked down the aisle at the Christmas show and sang Jingle Bell Rock, and I heard all those screams and cheers coming from everywhere, it really lit a fire under me that maybe I should start singing, or at least, you know, being in chorus. And that kind of grew from, I started a little band. And so I had a little band that we played a couple times, you know, at somebody's house or whatever in high school. And then what really lit the fire underneath me was my freshman year when I was in college. I came home at Christmas time, and I had a little group of guys. We played a field party in Gallatin, Tennessee, and there was a guy that owned a booking agency there. His name was Bruce Binkley, and the company was called Crescent Moon Talent, and they booked SEC school frat houses all across the Southeast. And he asked me, he said, man, would you guys be interested in signing with us? He said, do you have 3 hours of material? Of course we didn't. And I lied my tail off and I said, oh yeah,
of course
we've got 3 hours. And he said, well, send me your set list. And sent him songs that I knew that we would learn. And so, And so basically, when we got up, piled up in my buddy's mother's van with a U-Haul on the back and headed down the road and started playing frat houses, that was so enjoyable for me at that age. It was such an impressionable age, you know, 19, 20 years old. And you know, this would have been 1996 or 1997. I mean, to make $1,500 for playing two hours with free beer and pizza and everybody jamming at the frat house, yeah. that was something that turned, that was a reality. It was the first time I'd ever made $1,500, you know, at 20 years old. And so I think that's when I knew I wanted to do music for a living, but I had not began writing songs yet.
Okay. That's a really cool story though. And similarly, there are a lot of times on this show when I'll refer to the old expression, the disclaimer, results not typical. Matt, in your case, where I'm going with this is, to continue that story, you were discovered after someone heard your CD playing in the background at a gas station? My gosh, please walk us through
correct.
That. Walk us through that. Wow.
So that guy that worked at the gas station was in the cover band that I had. And so when I figured out, so the cover band fell apart, and I realized that I was going to have my own songs if I wanted any great musicians to play with me. So I just started trying to write my own songs. I pretty much listened to Van Morrison, Tupelo Honey, and then there was a record, a Willie Nelson record called Teatro that was produced by Daniel Lanois. I listened to those records so much, and I basically stole the chords. I would learn to play those songs, and they were pretty basic chords. And then so I would just change the groove with the chords and change the melody and put my own words into it. That's how I started writing songs. So I wrote 10 songs, and I recorded those 10 songs with a group of guys, and we had the CD made, and he was at work at the gas station. And Rick Hall from Muscle Shoals, who had, you know, discovered Aretha Franklin, and he was an icon in the music industry. His son lived out on the peninsula where this gas station was, and so they came in to get some ice or something, and Rick said, "Who is that you're listening to?" He said, "Well, this is my band." And he said, "Well, who's singing?" He said, "Well, that's my buddy Matt." He said, "Well, who's writing the songs?" He said, "He is." And so they took the CD, Rick took the CD with him, brought it back in a few hours, and I had put my number inside the sleeve when we printed them, and you know, for booking. And so Rick and his son Mark Hall, they called me and they said, "Hey, we really love this record. We want to know what's going on with it, and if you'd be interested to sign a publishing deal." I didn't know what a publishing deal was, so, but I knew about Rick Hall and Muscle Shoals, so. So I came down and I met with them, and we basically spent an hour hanging out, and they offered me a contract to write songs for them. I would have signed it on spot, but I thought it would be proper of me to at least pretend that I had a lawyer look at the deal. And so that's
so
how I
cool.
got started as a,
so
as a
cool.
staff writer.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, that path is not, I have people ask me all the time, they're like, "Oh, how did you get into it?" And I was like, everybody gets into it, you know, in their own way. I mean, some people take a traditional role or, you know, way in, but also that was, gosh, 20 something years ago.
Yeah.
So it's totally different now. But my guess is that everybody's way into the music business is going to be different. I mean,
no doubt.
Guerrilla warfare works.
Folks, I invite you to write to me via podcast at nhte.net. I want to do a mailbag segment on this show and read whatever you send in, comments, stories, maybe a favorite interview, or perhaps you are an up-and-coming performer and you want to highlight something that you learned from an episode of this podcast. Email me and I will read some or all of it on an upcoming episode, along with at least your first name and preferably where you are from. Continue to listen. And be sure, too, that you are receiving the free weekly e-newsletter, because I foresee one, if not two, trips in May, and I would love to meet listeners of this show when I am out on the road, so I can say a personal thank you face-to-face for listening to Now Hear This Entertainment each week. Matt, I thought that the hearing your music playing at a gas station story was unusual, but what is this about getting fired from the Gary Allen tour as a merch person?
Yeah, so I became Gary Allen's merch guy on the Smoke Rings in the Dark tour. That would have been the summer of 2000. And really didn't know a whole lot about pop country at the time, if you would consider Gary Allen pop country, which I don't really think that I would. But anyway, my parents went to high school with the people that owned the merchandise company that did Gary Allen's merch. And so they ran into me at my waiting tables gig. I was waiting tables at Chili's in Rivergate, which is right outside of Nashville. And they asked me if I wanted to go on tour selling t-shirts. And this was right before I'd gotten into my first original band, where the record that got me signed by Rick Hall. And so I said, yeah, I'd love to go out on tour. That sounds like a lot of fun. And so they said, well, we have two acts. You can either go Rascal Flatts or Gary Allen. And I didn't know either of them. And I said, I'm not really sure what a Rascal Flatt is, so I'll go out with Gary Allen. And so that summer was amazing. We toured. We literally, I think we got on the bus like around May 1st and didn't come home until September. We were just gone for weeks on end. And it was a old school tour. It was a lot of fun. Gary taught me a ton about country music, and I taught him a lot about rock and roll. And and at the end of the tour is when I first started writing one of my first songs in the back of the bus. And Gary opened the door. I was back there, and he said that he heard me writing a song, and he's like, I think it's time for me to fire you. And I said, well, I've got all my merch is set up, you know, is everything okay? He's like, no, you know, you need to be writing songs. So he's like, I know that you're not really a merch guy. You're just out here filling in. So we want somebody that's going to actually, you know, be here to do this job. And he said, you've got a real knack for writing. And wow, if I were you, I'd go back and pursue that.
Fantastic.
That's about the time that I signed my first publishing deal, was right after I'd worked with Gary. And he really encouraged me to go, you know, pursue the songwriting thing.
Yeah. And lo and behold, your first number one was 2012, 2013, Every Storm by Gary Allen. Take us back to that. Who did you write it with? Did you have any sense that it had number one potential when y'all finished writing it? And for that matter, do you remember where you were when you first learned that it went to number one?
First part of the question, I wrote that with Gary and Hillary Lindsay. And I do remember feeling that it was a special song. I don't know about number one. I mean, all of that is so subjective. You know, I've got songs of mine that have never even been recorded that I think are my best material that may never hear the light of day, you know, as far as songs I've written for others. So you never really know. It's hard to, you know, when a song goes number one, there's so many things that has to happen for that to happen. But I did feel and believe that it was a special song. But there again, wasn't really sure if anything was going to happen with it. And so we found out that it was number one. I remember I was in my apartment in West Nashville the night that it went number one. And it was a really a surreal feeling. I had kind of had a bunch of success with Gary Allen early on. So I started to think in my mind, I was like, oh, this is going to be an easy thing. This is how you do it. You know, I'm here to stay. So it's been a long time since that song went number one, but it was a special song for me. It changed my life. And it really has continued to, you know, when you have success as a songwriter, not only do you, you know, you get the accolades and you get the financial bonuses of having a number one, but if you're a performing songwriter, that turns into a lot of gigs if you're willing to go out there and play and travel. And that's kind of still what I'm doing all these years later, is I'm still playing songwriter festivals. And a lot of people, I kind of have one foot in the rock and roll Americana world and one foot in the country world. You know, there's a lot of people who are country fans and songwriter fans that really are just now seeing that I'm an artist myself, you know, but the people who grew up with me know that I started out as an artist and kind of got sidetracked in a good way when Gary Allen came into my life. And so I spent 15 years doing that. But now, you know, this was all a realization after I got sober and I thought, you know, I'm not getting any younger. I'm really going to go back to pursuing being an artist only because that's where my heart is. And we're kind of at a time in life and in music where there are so many private gigs that you can play. There's a lot of ways to make money as a performing artist where you don't necessarily have to have millions of fans and you don't have to be able to sell out a club to go and make $4,000 or $5,000, you know, and having hits with, you know, having a song like Every Storm Runs Out of Rain helps to up my price. So if there's a, you know, I play a ton of parties and like, you know, neighborhoods will get together and they'll have a neighborhood or a cul-de-sac party and they'll get a food truck and they'll hire me and two other hit songwriters. And we can go for the weekend to Park City, Utah and get to hang out in the mountains and make some money. And then I'll go next week and I'll come to Florida or I'll go wherever, or, you know, then we'll do a theater gig. Or so it's really just about, you know, what do you want to do with your art? Are you just a songwriter and you want others to cut your songs? Or are you an artist who can write? And are you willing to go out there and do all the little small gigs to put all the pieces together to make your yearly income? And so that's just kind of where I'm at, because it's getting harder and harder unless you're in a camp to get a song to an artist that's successful so that you can have a radio hit. And if you're not having radio hits, you're really not making any money. And if you don't own the masters to any recordings of any of these artists that are cutting your songs, you're not making any money. So it's kind of, it's a new world and a new game. And so instead of trying to beat my head against the wall writing a song for Morgan Wallen that's probably not going to get to him because he's got a huge camp that he pretty much sources all of his material from. I'm like, man, I'm an artist myself. Why don't I just find out who my crowd is, find out who likes me, and then I'll just, you know, target market them, you know, and say, hey, I'd love to come. I'll do private gigs. And then so now I've got a little team around me. We're trying to make a run at it, at the whole artist thing. You know, it'll be a different route than most artists go, but I've always kind of taken my own route, and that's kind of where I am today.
No, but you know, I like that approach. I'm starting to hear it from, I don't want to overstate it, but I'm starting to hear it from a few more guests. I remember last September 11th, I recorded an interview with Brett James, and then tragically, he died a week later in a plane crash, and then his episode of Now Hear This Entertainment came out 6 days later. And for those that don't know who Brett James was, my gosh, 27 number one songs. He had more than 800 of his songs recorded by some of the biggest artists in the world. And he said on that interview that despite all this success he'd had as a songwriter, he was about to go back and do another solo project because it had been so long. And even very recently, Jerry Salley said that all these years that I've done this, I'm not getting any younger. He said, and I still don't think I've written my best song yet. And, you know, he was talking about his latest artist project. So we are starting to hear more of that, of where people like yourself, Matt, are taking a step back and looking and saying, hey, you know what? You know, I'm not getting any younger. And I want to, there is the artist side of me that I want people to know more about. And we just need to identify who that audience is, how to get in front of them, and let's have some fun. Let's have some success.
Absolutely. That is the route a lot of us are taking. And with the AI thing coming into play, I think that it's going to be very valuable for those of us who are performing songwriters. The AI will never be able to get up on stage and tell a story like we can.
Well said. Well said. I am joined today on the Now Hear This Entertainment guest line from Nashville by singer, songwriter, guitar player Matt Warren. Stick around, because we are also going to be talking about the hat that he wears as one of the founders
of the Las Vegas Songwriters Festival, which comes up this August at the Mandalay Bay Resort and Casino. Matt Warren's EP, released last October, is called Heartbreak Superstar. Buy it from iTunes and other online digital music retailers. Follow Matt on Instagram. Keep up with him for details on when and where you can see him go perform live. Subscribe to his official YouTube channel. And yes, you can follow him and stream his music on Spotify. But again, it's far better in terms of supporting him if you purchase downloads of his original music, the new EP, and or his back catalog. Earlier, I was saying that I am anticipating one, if not two, trips in May. That being said, I realize I cannot be everywhere. And so in an effort to connect with audience members in locations I will not get to, I invite you to join me online for a virtual coffee. On my podcast website, nhte.net, there is a bright yellow Buy Me a Coffee button that will allow you to do exactly that. Well, you can buy more than one if you would like. You will see others before you who have done so, the messages that they have written to me, as well as the replies that I posted back to them. It's a nice way for you to let me know that you appreciate the work that I am doing with this show every week, every month, more than 12 years now. Matt, at the beginning of this episode, we played your song Long Story, and you told us about that single, but I want the audience to understand the difference between what you were talking about before the break, having been a writer on a number one song for Gary Allen, and your song, Long Story, being a number one on radio in Texas this year. This time it was you as the artist. I wonder, did that mean more because it was you as the artist?
Oh my gosh, yes, exponentially. I mean, again, that's, I only say that, I'm not sure every songwriter would say that, but I only say that because I'm an artist first. And so that was my ultimate goal way back when I was, you know, a youngster in 1996. So to be able to hear my own song, me singing on the radio and have a number one in Amarillo, Texas, was kind of a, gosh, a 25, 26 year long dream goal of mine. It's always nice to ride down the road and turn on the local country station and hear some other person singing your song, but that's not what turns me on. Mm-hmm. You know, I want to be able to be the artist, and to sing songs that mean something to me. And that's the ultimate goal for me.
Well said, well said. And that kind of leads to, while we're talking about number one songs, I want to gush a little bit over more of what Matt has accomplished. Over 71 songs that have been recorded, a multi-platinum selling song, two-time ASCAP award winner, ACM Song of the Year nominee. Now, Matt, let's go back to early in this interview and the Matt Warren that was born and raised in Nashville, the bands that you were talking about starting up and playing in. Were these types of accomplishments that I just read off, were those what you were thinking of when you decided, you know what, I can do this music thing for a living?
No, not at all. Because when I thought that I could do this music thing for a living, quote unquote, that was being in a band. My thought was, well, if we're getting paid to play fraternity parties and we're getting calls back, that must mean that someone likes us. And so that is what fueled the fire. But it was very soon after that, I realized that, like, okay, you can't really make a great living in a cover band. And when I kind of put my head around, okay, you're going to have to write your own songs. I started writing songs out of necessity, because I needed a band. I needed songs to sing, but I soon found out, after I'd made that record, that's how Gary kind of knew that I was a songwriter. He'd heard me writing a song. And then when I made the record, he said, you know, Gary and I were friends for 6 years before we ever even wrote. You know, he loved my record. He thought I was a great artist. His kids would all sing the songs. And and so it wasn't until, you know, 6 years later that he said, man, you know, you and I should write a song sometime. Mm. And I'd never really co-written. And so I thought, well, I guess that, sure, we could write a song. I didn't know that I'd be able to, you know, what he did and what I did were maybe two different things, but he liked it enough to think that we could write together. And the first song that we ever wrote was a song called Putting Memories Away, which he cut. And that is what threw me over into the country world, because I thought, you know, right now I'm trying to get my own thing started and keep a band together, and it's not really going at the speed I'd like it to.
I see.
The minute that Gary cut one of my songs, I thought, man, I've got a guy who's got a major label record deal who's into my stuff. Maybe I should just focus on writing songs for
Gary.
That was the detour that happened from me pursuing my own artistry.
Wow. But just a tremendous journey, though, from having the high school band to the story that you told about the Hall family, Fame Recordings, Muscle Shoals, the gas station story, and now that, you know, being the merch guy who all of a sudden is told, no, you're not going to be the merch guy anymore. You gotta go and write these songs yourself. And so I've teased this a couple times. Fast forward to present day. Tell us about this other hat that you wear. Tell us about the Las Vegas Songwriters Festival coming up in August. You're one of the founders, and this will be the second year for it. How many writers will perform? Does it cost for people to attend? Presumably, these are all writers' rounds, I'm guessing. Give us all the details about the event.
Yes, so this event, there are tickets available. There's multi-level packages. You can go to LasVegasSongwriterFestival.com and find out all that information. But as far as how it got started, like I was talking about earlier, for probably the last 5 to 10 years, I've kind of been playing a ton of songwriter festivals. And the songwriter festival is just something that started to pop up over the last several years. And so, to make a long story short, I had been playing a show in Mandalay Bay in Las Vegas, called Nashville Unplugged. My friend Aaron Benward had started that show there 17 years ago. Mm. And I became one of the show favorites, and the COO of Mandalay Bay, Chuck Bowling, and his wife Claire were just really huge fans of mine and really were kind to me, took me under their wing, and they would hire me to play private parties.
Wow.
And Chuck and Claire said, we'd love you to meet our daughter. And this is just, you know, the raw truth is I met their daughter. We fell in love and we got married.
Wow.
And Chuck, being such a music fan, really encouraged me he's like, hey, you know, you ought to think about growing your business other than just, you know, writing and performing these gigs. You know, what about if we put our heads together on how to do some gigs through my connections? And so initially I had thought that maybe I wanted to do some like corporate event gigs or some private corporate events that would happen there at the Mandalay Bay, because that would be big companies spending big money. So I'm a songwriter with a company called Intersong, and I knew that there was a business model in place with Intersong. And so when Chuck was asking me, you know, about growing this business, I said, let me get my friend Rob Hatch on a call with us, because he has a company that has all of these hit songwriters that basically do private corporate events. And so we brought Rob into this call with Chuck, and, you know, Chuck had really seen the songwriter festival thing because of me and others who had played there at Mandalay Bay. And so we all came up with the idea to have a songwriter festival at Mandalay Bay. Mm. And that's basically the bare bones of how this thing got started. It was Mike Every and Rob and I and Chuck Bowling all put our heads together, and MGM and Mandalay Bay and Intersong all agreed upon starting a songwriter festival there.
So,
and
good.
Last year was our first year, and it was tremendous.
So good. And I know you're proud of the Las Vegas Songwriters Festival. There's something that you mentioned very early on that I know you're also really proud of, which is your sobriety. I do want to give you a chance to share that story with the audience, please. I think we all like hearing good news.
Yeah, man. I around, like I said, 2019, I had let a prescription Adderall, which is basically just, if you look at the ingredients on an Adderall bottle, it's salt and amphetamine. And so I had started taking this Adderall as a ways and means to finish songs, because, you know, as a songwriter, if you're a paid songwriter, you have to write Monday through Friday. And sometimes, you know, you get in a rut and you just get stumped. And I would say, well, let's just get back together. Of course, it'd be 2 or 3 months later that we actually get back together and try to finish this song. So there was a little bit of pressure from my publishing company saying, hey, we got to turn more songs in. And so some friends of mine had been taking Adderall, and they said that it worked for them. And so I started taking Adderall, and it just went from taking it when I was writing to then I would take it if I had chores to do or make a long drive or anything like that. And then it went from that to every single day when I wake up, I'd have to take Adderall to feel normal. And basically started taking that around 2009 or 2010 and had about a 10-year run with it. And I mean, there were other stuff going on in my life at the time too. I was drinking and doing other drugs and smoking pot and all this stuff. But it was the Adderall that really sunk its teeth into me. And so I had about a decade of doing that until it got to the point to where I just basically had a mental breakdown. I had a few things happen in my life, in my personal life, and I had a run in with the law and kind of realized that I couldn't live like this any longer, or I was going to die, or cool. I was either going to end up in jail, in an institution, or in a coffin.
Whoa.
So I went to Sheila Biddy at Music Health Alliance here in Nashville. And I was going to see if they could get me some. At the time, I thought I just needed counseling, you know, and she asked me, she said, well, what's wrong? And I said, well, I feel like I'm spiritually parched. I'm just a shell of a man. And she said, well, are you on drugs? And I said, I am. And she said, well, do you think you could use rehab? And I said, well, I mean, I'm sure I'd benefit from it, but I have no money. And she said, well, let me contact Music Cares, and I'll give you a shout back. And she called me back in about 15 minutes and got me $30,000 to go for 30 days at Cumberland Heights. And I checked in on February the 19th, 2019, and checked out on March 20th, 2019. And it was the best decision I ever made in my life. It was a real life changer, to say the very least.
Outstanding. Outstanding. And audience, for those of you that don't know what Music Cares is, that falls under the Recording Academy. I actually did an interview with somebody from the Recording Academy talking about the Music Cares program, my gosh, several years ago, way back on episode 270. But it's worth the listen. It's a program that still operates to this day. Really great service that they provide. Here's a little fun fact that I thought we'd have you tell us about, Matt, as we start to wind things down. You are not only a faithful fan of the band Widespread Panic, but of the Grateful Dead as well. And you even got to meet their co-founder, Bob Weir, who passed away in January.
Yes. I didn't get to shake his hand, but we made eye contact. I was friends with Audley Freed, who was in the Black Crowes. Audley played on a record of mine. And through making my record, another friend of mine who was on the record, Steve Gorman, who was also a drummer in the Black Crowes, him and my buddy Tom Bukovec got to be friends. And they said, hey, we need a guy. We need a lead guitar player for this band Trigger Hippie that we're in. That was Joan Osborne and Steve Gorman on drums. Jackie Green was in the band. And so Chris Robinson, Jackie Green, and Bob Weir from the Grateful Dead had a little trio. And they came to the Ryman. And my buddy Audley, who was friends with Jackie because Jackie had been in the Black Crowes, Audley called me. He said, hey, man, I've got you on the list for the Bob Weir show, and got you a backstage pass. Mm. And so I go to the show, I go backstage to the Ryman, and we're all back there singing this song, a song by the great Russell Smith called Third Rate Romance, and which was originally performed by the Amazing Rhythm Aces. So we're backstage singing this song, and Chris Robinson, my singing idol, is looking right at me. We're singing harmony to this song, which was on that level alone was just astonishing to me that I was getting to sing with my hero backstage. But I noticed that everybody's eyes kind of shifted and were looking at me, and I turned around and Bob Weir was standing right behind me and just kind of looked at me and raised his eyebrows a little and nodded his head and then walked out of the room. And, nice. And I was like, what world am I living in where Chris Robinson and Bob Weir are approving of our song?
Nice. Wow. But, you know, I love those of you in the audience that are aspiring performers. You hear it all the time and you can't hear it enough. The connections are so valuable, right? That's how Matt got in there in the first place. In fact, we have a lot of names in common. You've heard me mention some of them throughout this interview. Rob McNelly, he was the guest on episode 548 of this show. He played on Matt's new EP. And Matt, you've written with Maggie Rose. She was on the show way back, episode 71.
Yes, I love Maggie so much. She's such an amazing talent. We write together. She sang on the record. Rob McNelly is one of the greatest guitar players that's ever been. He's played on not only my record, but a ton of my demos. We also used to have a band together back in the day. And then Russell Dickerson, who you mentioned earlier, he's a friend of mine as well. And so is Brett James.
Wow. Whew, good stuff.
Maggie is I think that she is on her way. I mean, to me, she's already a star, but I think she's going to be a household name. She's just an amazing talent.
No doubt. We are going to close today with another one of Matt's original songs, the title track from the EP he released last October, Heartbreak Superstar. Before I let you go, Matt, and we play that song, share with the audience first all about this one, if you would, please.
Heartbreak Superstar was a poem that I had written, and I had a writing appointment with James Slater and Skip Black one morning, and we wrote a song really fast, and Skip decided to go home and do some work, and so James and I decided to stay and write another song, and James is a great piano player, and so we kind of wanted to write something that was in the vein of Billy Preston or Randy Newman, and so James said, do you have any ideas or any song titles or anything? So I handed him my phone with my notes in it, and he came across the Heartbreak Superstar poem. He's like, man, this is really cool. Let's work on this. And so basically he played the piano and I sang, and we edited the lyrics a little bit. But that's how that song came to be. And I noticed that every time I play it out, people just loved it and always wanted to hear that. And so when we went to record this new record, we kind of built it around Heartbreak Superstar, the song.
What is the story of Heartbreak Superstar? What's the story being told?
I just wrote that poem. I had the title, and I was just trying to make up a story. Some of it's true, some of it's not. I'll let the listener decide on what part they want to be true or not. But it's really just me writing a poem that was flowing. You know, it was just a play on words.
Okay. Good stuff. Matt, wonderful to talk to you. Thank you ever so much. I really enjoyed it. I appreciate you making time to be on Now Hear This Entertainment.
Thank you for having me, Bruce.
My pleasure. Audience, with that, I will wrap up another new episode of Now Hear This Entertainment. My sincere thanks to singer, songwriter, guitar player Matt Warren. His EP, released last October, is called Heartbreak Superstar. Buy it from iTunes and other online digital music retailers. Last night, I followed Matt on Instagram, and I'm sure he would appreciate you doing the same. Keep up with him for details on when and where you can go see him perform live. Subscribe to his official YouTube channel. And yes, you can follow him and stream his music on Spotify. But again, as I said earlier, it is far better in terms of supporting him if you purchase downloads of his original music, the new EP, and or his back catalog. You also heard him talk today about the event coming up in August at Mandalay Bay Resort and Casino. Visit LasVegasSongwritersFestival.com for all the details. And just to clarify, Matt will be performing at that event. That will do it for episode 637. Thanks ever so much for listening. I will send you out today with another song from Matt Warren. This is the one he just talked about. It's called Heartbreak Superstar.
I'm a heartbreak superstar. I was born in the back of my daddy's car on the night that he broke my mama's heart in Apalachicola. Now here I am playing my part. I've got my elbows propped up on the bar, and I don't have a clue where I should start. Oh, but I wanna get to know ya. What can I say? Hey, what can I do? We ain't even met, but I'm in love with you. You're like the beat of a drum in the jungle, baby. Like when they hung Jesus on the cross to save me. I'm an honest politician. I am a southern boy. I'm a bad love magician. I'm like a broken string on an old guitar, y'all. I'm a heartbreak superstar. I'm a little like herd and cats. I'm old soul music. I am your favorite hat. I'm a high head, city slick and navy brat. Now don't you say that I never warned you. The sweetest guy you will ever meet, well, he's sitting right here. He's got them flip-flop feet. I got my toenails painted, but I ain't sweet. I am a whistle-dixie rock and roller. What can I say? Hey, what can I do? We just met and I'm in love with you. You're like the beat of a drum in the jungle, baby. Like when they hung Jesus on the cross to save me. I'm an honest politician. I am a southern boy. I'm a bad love magician. I'm like cigarette smoke. I'm a wild card shot in the dark. Lord, I'm a heartbreak superstar. I have a hunch you're the one. You bought me three double shots of banana rum, and you quoted Jackie Chan from Cannonball Run. And you ran the bulls in Barcelona. What can I say? Hey, what can I do? I love you, girl. Baby, that's the truth. You're like the beat of a drum in the jungle, baby. Like when they hung Jesus on the cross to save me. I'm an honest politician. I am a southern boy. I'm a bad love magician. And I've been known to take things a little too far. Just like my mama used to say, you can't be nothing but who you are. And I'm a heartbreak superstar. You are what you are, yeah. And I'm a heartbreak. I'm a heartbreak superstar. Oh, whoa-oh. Yeah, yeah. A heartbreak superstar. Yeah, I'm a heartbreak superstar.